Now, those that have questions, will you come up to the mic and give your name, be brief as you can with your question. So, can we start with the questioning?
Thank you. I just can't tell you how disappointed I am that John Boris isn't here. He always has to. John, where are you? I don't believe this. But anyway, Dennis, you're up.
No, John's just being quiet as always, right? Bridget,
continue your name?
Oh, sorry. My name is Dennis King. Continuing care, changing to that social model that you referred to earlier, means that, of course, staff in the facilities, in the lodges, the long-term care centers, and things like that, are not going to be on site. It seems then that home care would be one alternative for providing the kinds of services that previously were attendant to a facility. Was there any discussion in your task force discussions and meetings about upgrading home care here in Alberta? Because it's my perception that across Alberta, home care within each of the RHAs is the poor sister of the organization.
Thank you for that, Dennis, and certainly it gives me the chance to repeat my mantra that I want provincial standards for anyone in care, and I don't care where they live. So those provincial standards would apply to home care, to the application of the care that home care would then provide. And you're quite right, there's huge changes out there, and it was discussed, but the other thing that I think that's important that was discussed is that people have to truly understand when they move into whichever form of housing they choose, what kind of care is going to be provided. And if you are being provided, as I mentioned, with the minimal of care, which home care would provide, because it would be the same as what's in your home, then you better be prepared to pick up the extra. One of the things that was loud and clear is that one bath a week is not considered a standard. Now, one bath a week for someone who is mobile and basically independent is probably sufficient in terms of them keeping themselves clean. But for someone who's in bed 24 hours a day, it's just not acceptable. So, yes, home care was discussed, and I would suspect, at least this is what I would want, is that the home care delivery of care would come under provincial standards.
Well,
thank you very much. Thanks, Bridget, for coming here and educating people about what's happening in Alberta. My question is actually related to very similar, but it's slightly different. There are some people who are homebound, and the Lethbridge Society of Meals on Wheels, they look after them. I don't know if they're on any government database or anything. If it wasn't these volunteers working for the Meals on Wheels Society, they wouldn't see anybody. They are homebound. They get one hot meal a day, and that's it. Is that somewhere in that program, Bridget, that we could maybe help them? My name is Balbura. I didn't mention my name in the beginning. And I'm the president of Meals on Wheels Society, so that's what I'm bringing. And, you know, the problems are just starting. The challenges are just starting. We have baby boomers coming right behind. We got to think about some of these issues and how are we going to deal with that? We got to have standards. So I hope you include that in your submission.
Oh, thanks, Val. That wasn't in that context was discussed, but I think that it probably is an indication of something that's been happening in our system over the last 8 to 10 years, in that families and volunteers, which Meals on Wheels is, has taken up a huge portion of providing the care that people are receiving. But my point is that if we took away those volunteers and we took away those families, then some families have actually had to give up jobs to ensure that their people are being fed. If we took away that segment of the system, it truly would fall, because in my mind, volunteers and family participation is the gravy. It's not the part of the system, and that's where it's fallen down. It makes the system look better than it really is.
Ann Hatford, I just want to ask, you talked about you talked about stories that you got and stories here and there. What are some of the stories you got?
Oh, thanks for that, Ann. Where does one start? Perhaps I'll do the one that's probably the most public. There's a woman named Ruth Marie Adria, who is the president of the Elder Advocates Association of Alberta. And she has brought forward a class action lawsuit against the government. And her contention is that when the rents were raised 40%, they were promised better care. In fact, the rents went up 40% and staff was laid off. So she is asking for that percentage back. One of the other things that she has done and what actually got her started were the two scalding deaths that occurred. They were very, very significant, and they were very, very sad. We have stories of people being left on toilets. We have stories of people being put into a tens probably before they really needed it, but because there wasn't the staff to help them, they have been told things like, it's all right, you can just wet your diaper. Well, what sort of dignity is that? It just isn't there. There's some very, very sad tales, and there's some stuff that's crossed my desk. One of them is, and I can share this, I have permission to share this. This little man had looked after his wife who had had his first stroke. And these couples have been together for 50 and 60 years. She had had a second stroke, and she had been reassessed out of the hospital to go to assisted living. He begged them, please don't send her to assisted living. Please, she needs long-term care. He wasn't listened to, and a day and a half later, she had fallen out of bed and broken her hip and died. And I don't want to talk about it because I'm going to cry. There's some pretty sad stuff out there. And I think that's where we absolutely have to be able in some way to put a dollar figure on dignity. Otherwise, dignity won't be recognized.
Good response, Bridget. Any more questions here? Surely there must be.
Austin Fennell, thank you very much for coming and speaking to us about this. I would be interested in, you passed over this very lightly as some expectation that you believe the government wants to do something. I would be interested to hear what signals you got, what kind of things were being said. And the second question I have to do is your two colleagues that were on the committee, did they send some signals of any things that they would really like to want to work on, that they were maybe not quite ready to die for, but they were important?
I can't think of anything specific to actually answer your question, but I think that I would be very correct in saying that the three of us came away with exactly the same desire to improve this system. I'm not altogether sure that the other two didn't go in particular, and I will name him, in particular Ray. I think went in with a different attitude of what he was going to find, and he came out certainly a different person and more than willing to say, we've got to make changes now. We have to have standards. So the specifics are a little bit hard to address, but things like accountability is a very, very important thing, because what's happened in housing, the division of housing and care, if the government sends $20 through the regional health authorities. What sort of a process do we have that we know that $20 is going directly to the front lines? My question is, if you are a private operator, housing operator, or even a housing operator that operates for a nonprofit, if your utility bills, if the walls need to be painted, if the sidewalks need to be shoveled, what dollar is that? Is that the housing dollar? Or is that the care dollar? What is food? Is that a housing dollar? Or is that a care dollar? What are attends? Are those personal dollars or are those really health care dollars? This is a huge discussion that will go on, and the standards partly address that in separating the housing from the care. And this is where these standards are so very, very important. I, for one, am not calling for these standards to be done tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. I want even more public input into them once they get that final document put together. And I want it done with great care because it's going to affect all of us sitting in this room. But it's going to affect society as a whole. Because if we cannot look after the most vulnerable in our society, then we've missed something that really affects our souls. And as I said to one of the heads of the Regional Health Authority, and I often use personal experiences because it's easier for me to remember, is that I have a daughter in the system who is a personal care aide, and she is a very hardworking personal care aide. But the system is destroying her soul. And that is not right in a province this rich.
Bob Anderson. Bridget, you seem to be on track up to this point. Sounds good to me. What I would like to know is what, if you can tell us anything about the plans you are now concocting deep in the inner recesses of your office to attempt to prevent dust from gathering on the report. What are you going to do as an MLA and a representative of Lethbridge to keep this thing going, to keep it alive? What kind of fire are you going to have?
Well, that's interesting. Not long ago, the Premier had sent me a message through a reporter, and it was cute as always. Our exchanges have always been cute up to this point, where he said, well, ask Bridget who pulled her strings. And I think that was in terms of writing my own report. And I said, you know, it's been a long time since the Premier and I sat down face to face, and he's probably forgotten that there's not many people that pull my strings. So I certainly intend to be very vocal. I pretty much call it the way I see it. I've been very privileged to be able to do that, and I will continue to do that. I also think, though, that how I see it playing out is that this report will go forward to the ministers, and once this interim report goes forward to the ministers, it is then basically out of the hands of the task force. It is up to the minister's department. So my vision of this is that the two PC members will go to their caucus and fight for the dollars that they believe that should be put into the system now. And I will go to my caucus and I will fight from the outside saying, where is this? Why aren't you doing this? And I'll do it through the press as much as I can. I will do it by encouraging people like you to keep writing the government and saying, you know what, we need that money now. They talk about $250 million, but I think that that's the money, not being privileged to all of the number crunching, but I think that's the dollars that they're talking about that will take this to its fruition through a whole new set of standards and getting those in place. I don't believe that it'll cost nearly that kind of money to put money into long-term care now and at least give them the relief there until they get these standards into place. So I have every intention of being seen and heard and encouraging, as I say, people like you. So, Bob, I am expecting your letter to cross my desk. on its way to the minister. Thank you.
Well, perhaps you just answered my question, but I was waiting for you to talk about what strikes me as the bottom line politically, Bridget.
Terry Shillington.
And that is the cost. And we live in a province where the public mantra is we don't want taxes and we don't want the government particularly involved in our lives. And so I was going to quiz you about what this really costs, because I suspect there's a cost to higher standards and we'll all pay it. And I'm personally prepared to pay it, but it's a political issue in our province, as you know, taxes and whether we want to pay for anything. And is $250 million a year what you think this all costs, or is that the beginning, or and how are we going to soften the public up to this?
Well, as I mentioned before, I'm certainly not privileged to the number crunching that they've actually come up with a $250 million for. So I really don't know exactly what that is going to cost. But in answer to something else that you said where we don't want the government involved, well, I think if we look around, we will see that the government's imprint is on almost every single thing that we do in our lives, in particular in services. Now, the services basically should be the responsibility of the government, but this government, I don't think, has met them in the way that we would like them to be met, in particular to reflect the dollars that we have in this province. I'm not sure that by looking at these standards and revamping the way we do things, and in fact one of my suggestions was to roll two departments into one, I think that we really have to start at the top and start looking at the administration and how we deliver these programs. And I believe that that would give us some relief in terms of the dollars. I'm not saying that we should cut out staff. I want some of the staff more retrained. But I don't think that this is an issue that should be political. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. I really don't think that it's important who wrote these reports. It's important that they go forward. It's important that they be acted on. And who wrote them really isn't important. If we get action, that's what's important.
Good afternoon. My name is Nadia Campbell. And Bridget, what I would like to mention is that I think some people have been talking about perhaps the bottom line. And what I'm thinking is nothing of this is going to really matter, and none of this will ever come to pass unless there is staff to do this. And to get staff to do this, and you were talking about your daughter who is working frontline and how she is getting burnt out. And that's because the staff has been laid off. There is one person doing the work perhaps of now of three. And I have a daughter-in-law that also works in long-term care. And she gets to have enough hours that will be just short of maybe 2 or 3 hours of full-time pay. So she does not get any benefits. She does not get really a good pay. So what incentive is there to keep people on working when there is nothing in it for them? And their heart isn't in it. They can't give because they don't have for what to give, because they don't have any benefits to look after their families or anything. I used to work for Statistics Canada in the 1980s. And the lady over me was saying, do you know that they are going to be putting people, they're going to be cutting full-time jobs and they're going to be taking away benefits and all these things. And all of us are, oh, that can't be true. They wouldn't do that. And look where we're at. We had so many more benefits and reasons to live way back before 1985 than we do now. What we need to do is get the government to be able to put people on full time so that they have some security, so they in turn can work and will give themselves to these jobs. Because all these task forces and all these wonderful plans will go nowhere if there are going to be no frontline workers with which to work with.
Well, thank you very much for that, Nadia. And actually, we've gone off into an area that I know very little about, and it's called lack of trained staff. And it isn't just Alberta, it's Canada. We have a huge labor problem out there. And just for an example that I will use, but let me backtrack, because the recommendations in the seniors' reports, and were very clearly recognized by this task force, is that there must be staff that has continuing jobs, because you need the continuity for the kind of care that the elderly need. It is recognized, it is in there, and they're also recommending that they work with the education department to ensure that the curriculums are set up, and set up now in particular for the PCAs, because they deliver 70% of the care. It isn't the RNs and it isn't the LPNs, it's really the PCAs. They're the ones that feed people. They're the ones that wipe bums. They're the ones that tuck the people into bed and give them a kiss. And you know what? That's what long-term care is about, at least in my mind. So back to the labor. We were certainly out in the rural, and I'll use Fort McMurray as an example. They're crying for staff up there. And they offer $12 an hour. $13, $14 an hour in that range, which is not a bad wage for somebody with very limited skills. But you know what? They can make money like that at McDonald's. Why on earth would they do the hard job of long-term care? So it's not just the fact that we need these people. There's a huge question about where we're even going to find them.
Hello, I'm Heather Caldwell. I'm finding this a little awkward because I'd like to look at Bridget while I ask my question. first, you know what? I am absolutely delighted to see that the family is identified in this document as critical to quality of life. And along those lines, I'm hoping that there are some recommendations made, and I wonder if you can address this, as to the separation of families. I find that both in my previous crisis work and in my own personal experiences within a health region, if we're looking at placement in long-term care facilities, they're placed in whichever spot opens first, be it Fort McLeod, be it Cardston, Raymond, anywhere in this area. And, of course, that separates family members, and particularly if it's a spouse that perhaps is no longer able to drive or is not safe to drive any longer, and also the separation of spouses when one is required to go into long-term. I find that situation heartbreaking, and I can't understand the justification for it, and I'm hoping you can address that.
Thanks very much for that, and you're quite right. Now, the one good thing about the fact of opening up different kinds of housing and getting some people that truly were inappropriate in long-term care moved into assisted living to help them become more independent, is that it has freed up some long-term care beds so that now people can stay closer to their community. But across this province, I won't say mainly in this area, but across this province, that has been a huge, huge issue. When I was on the campaign trail, I was over in a lodge, a manor, here in our city, and I had a 92-year-old woman who was blind crying on my shoulder because her husband had been taken to Cardston and she knew she would never see him again alive. It was absolutely heartbreaking and totally disgusting. Right now I have a case sitting on my desk where someone is trying to move both of their parents from one region to the next. And this is another thing, is that each region in this province seems to have their own different sets of rules, they have their own definitions, and they have their own way of allowing things to happen. And this is, why I think it's absolutely crucial that we have provincial standards that will go all across. If you want to move your mother from Fort McMurray to Lethbridge, that should be allowed. If you want to move them as a couple, that's got to be allowed. We have got to start recognizing that people have dignity. And I don't like to use the word rights. Why should we say that people have rights when in fact all it is just basic respect and dignity? It is a huge issue, and thank you for bringing that up. I think that slowly it is being addressed, as I say, because I think there are more beds opening up. But it still is a problem when each one of them is at a different care level. Now, not in this region, but certainly in Calgary and in Edmonton, I have been in very lovely facilities where, in fact, it is that continuum. It's sort of what I think St. Mike's thought they were doing with Martha's House, where you could actually sort of move across the parking lot. And as your needs moved, you just sort of moved within the whole institution. There are some of them out there, and they are being handled well. One of them, the woman, was at one end of the building, and her husband, who had severe Alzheimer's, was at the other end of the building. And this fellow actually was quite violent. As long as he could see his wife, he was fine. So that particular establishment could separate them for the night, but they came together during the day, and the wife was more than prepared to put those many hours in the day to actually being with her husband at all times, and it just seemed to calm him down. There are some good things going on out there. Don't get me wrong. I know that I've sounded negative, because there are negative things, but there are some good things going with this new paradigm, but we must have the standards. We can't just let it go off willy-nilly.
My name is Doreen Gorkas, and I'd like to just touch on a different subject here, and that is people who have disabilities. At one time, home care would go in and allow these people, particularly the young people with disabilities, to remain in their homes and be cared for and looked after. However, home care got cut, and these young people were placed in long-term care situations. 20, 30-year-old people put in with 70, 90-year-old people, and all of their opportunities to be free and go out into the community was taken away from them because personal care attendants were cut back, and I could go on and on for forever. Candy bus situations, if they had such a thing as being on oxygen, they wouldn't take them because they couldn't have the restraint across the top and so on. All of their personal dignity has been taken away from them because they're placed in such a situation with older people, and they have nobody to relate to and so on. Is any consideration being taken towards addressing this type of situation?
Well, thank you for that. And I know that I've probably predominantly spoken about my particular passion of the elderly and long-term care. But the task force looked at everyone in care. And that's why my little mantra is everyone in care, no matter where they live. It became very, very clear that there are young people out there. And in particular, there's an abnormal amount in Fort McMurray. They have a great many industrial accidents and also car accidents. And there are a number of young people, which raises the other question of transportation. There isn't enough handy bus type transportation, and who's going to pay for it? Which is another huge issue. Will this be downloaded onto the residents that need those handy buses? And in particular in the rural areas, some people have chosen to, rather than move to a larger center and get the better services that they need, they have chosen to stay in their communities because that's where they get the emotional support, and often that's more important than perhaps some of the physical things. But it was huge. It was addressed. The recommendations are there that people have to be appropriately placed. And appropriately does not mean the 45-year-old MS mother of three with the 90-year-old that has Alzheimer's and who may be violent. So the appropriate placing is addressed in those standards, and I'm trusting that those will be... there will be some mechanism that when people are being assessed, that they would be assessed. Now, having said that, I don't think that some of the assessment tools that are being used now, specifically for long-term care, should be used to place people in housing. They really were meant to be just for care. Sometimes they're being used to say, this is the care you need, therefore this is where you're going to live. And it's a mandated choice. There is no choice if it's mandated. So you must know that when you go into whichever kind of housing that you're going to go into, that the care that you need is there, and also that the appropriate people will be there for you to support each other, I guess. I think that if we have, I ran into two people. One was a 42-year-old mother of three with MS, and also a 45-year-old man. Now, those two people could be put in the same institution and really understand each other's needs and give each other support that none of us in this room or anyone that's even trained could possibly understand. We're not there. Yes, we can empathize, but it's not the same as actually being there and sharing. So appropriate placing is one of the big standards that is being talked about.
John Boris is my name. Thanks, Bridget. Something occurred to me as I listened to the debate and discussion. I'm a veteran. I don't buy being a veteran. I don't run them down. I'm just a veteran. But in all the years that I've been involved with a disability, and this is when before I came out of the service, it's been that disability pension has been there. No questions are asked. I went to places and they checked me over again. And the same thing. And all of a sudden, when I was reading the paper, I ran onto the veterans paper. And I noticed this program that was for VIPs, veterans in something or other. And I said, hey, they'll pay for snow removal, lawn cutting. Wait a minute. Just go and dial the 800 number. You know, I dialed that 800 number. Somebody was there next week, discussed the matter with me. I says, listen, I was quite surprised to see this. But you know, I said, I'm 82 years of age, or we'll be very close when we discuss this. And I said, I will be staying in my house, as my wife will, as we can. And we think it's a lot easier to pay for taking the snow off the sidewalk and cutting the grass than taking care of us in assisted or long-term, I don't even know, the deficients. And you know, immediately, I was given attention to it. And I send a bill, and they get it done. And I can stay at home. If I didn't have that, whoever's been in my house, they've noticed it's a house built for a big family. Family's gone. It's an empty barn. And so we don't need that. But we got to have somebody do something when it's there. So I'm wondering if it might help, Bridget. And if you're aware of this, I couldn't have been treated better ever. I've been treated so good that I thank the good Lord every day for it. Thank you.
Thanks very much, John. I'm just wondering, John didn't start, but I wonder if he's finishing and you're changing your pattern. You'll be the last person with questions. I'm glad to hear that you're being looked after as a veteran, because you know what? I wouldn't be here without you, and I think we do owe a great deal of gratitude to our veterans. Veterans Affairs, from what I understand, has also been looking at the funding that they would give to veterans. Before, it was just for people in long-term care. They have now relooked and are reviewing the fact that they will support veterans in other forms of housing. So I think it's very, very important, and I'm glad that you've got good care. I would love to think that all of the seniors in our province would get that kind of care and not have to be a veteran to get it. So thank you for that.
You're welcome for another question. And any more from the audience?
Thank you. Bridget, I was just reading in your report that you support the idea of an inspector general to monitor compliance standards and investigate reports of problems and abuse or neglect. If a facility is reviewed and comes up deficient, it doesn't seem to me feasible that we can just shut them all down. Do you have any specific ideas, or did the task force mention any ways in which facilities like that could be brought up to snuff, up to standard?
Thanks, Dennis. Yes, it was very clear. In fact, in the seniors' report, they are suggesting that every single institution that offers either housing or care be licensed. And in fact, if they're not meeting those standards, then their license would be pulled. And you're right. If you pull a license, then where are you, what are you going to do with the people? But I think that when anybody that would go out of what I would consider the Inspector General's office, they would actually be reviewing a facility from two different sets of standards, one for the housing and one for the care. They may meet housing, may not need care. What I'm suggesting is that in no uncertain terms, those recommendations would be back to those people within a month. They would be hopefully complied with instantly and have an evaluation every 2 weeks until they are met. And I think that even just the threat of having a license listed, in particular for those that are making a profit, I think that that would be an incentive for them to shape up their act. I also think that perhaps some of the problems that we're seeing, not on the care side but on the housing side, I think that we're going to see perhaps a decrease in those, because with privatization, often you'll find lawyers not far behind. And so I think that when people go in and sign contracts, they'll be very aware of what they're entitled to, and I think that these contracts will give them the power to go to whomever and say, this is not being adhered to, I need to have a complaint process. And speaking of that complaint process, this is one thing that was very loud and clear, and very loud and clear in the seniors' recommendations, is there must be a complaint process. There is nowhere for anyone to go so that they get any sort of redress. They're given the runaround is basically what they're given. And it's very clear that we must have, and one of the suggestions was that we have resident counsel in every facility. Sometimes that works depending on the cognitive ability and also the dedication of the people who are either family or the guardians. It isn't always feasible to have that type of thing. But there must be somewhere where people can go and that there is a very clear process to follow. And ultimately, maybe they would have to go to the Inspector General and bring it up. That isn't where I think it should be handled. I think it should be handled at the very front line where the complaint is being registered, not unlike what we have just been given in our courthouse, which has been operating, I think, probably for a year and a half now, a very successful mediation course. Rather than wasting the court's time, people are going into mediation. It's proved to be very, very, very beneficial. And I think that that method could be used in the long-term care and in the housing segment, but it would have to be a very clear process that these are the steps that you take so that at the end, people going into the process know that at the end there will be some sort of a resolution.
Do I have another question? Come on up. Yes?
I wanted to speak to the one gentleman's comment about taxes going up. And I think that there's a myth going around that we can't afford to give good service and we can't afford to give the dignity that we need to be giving. But in my opinion, we can't afford not to. And it doesn't have to be necessarily that taxes are going up. I think we get paranoid about that. I think of what you said, Bridget, about maybe some administrative shifts and some relocation of the way dollars are spent at other levels and maybe tax reform. But I think that, you know, I don't know if you have any comments around that, but I think there is that myth, that sense that